daughter in first grade, and I'm trying to teach her an alternative way of looking at the world. But what's interesting, Chris, is that I think years from now we'll look back and see, say no to the problems, and then we have to create the people power to say yes to the solution. And it takes time to do that. And interestingly, in this model of the eight stages of social movements, which come to us from the late Bill Moyer, not Moyers on television, but Moyer, a longtime activist, who wrote a really great book called Doing Democracy. In that book, he says, at smack dab in the middle of those eight stages is stage five, which is activist failure. That is to say, we haven't achieved enough people power to make the change yet, and we think we're done, and we're powerless, and we're not able to make any change at all. And it's those of us who actually know that change is possible who hang in there and then build the real movement. And what's that movement trying to do? It's trying to alert, educate, win, and mobilize the populace. To alert, educate, win, and mobilize the populace. And luckily, Chris, we're living in a time when in this country and around the world, people are doing this.
Yeah.
And we only have to Google search for it to begin to see that.
I know. The media doesn't really tell the truth about what's going on in this world, and it's unfortunate because there is so much positive, and we have a campaign locally called Respectful Revolution that I think is trying to pick up exactly what you're talking about. But you're writing right now about mainstreaming nonviolence. What's the difference between activism and nonviolence?
Well, nonviolence is a force. It's not a non-thing. It's a force for justice, peace, and the well-being of all, not almost all, that's neither passive nor violent. So it's a force for justice, peace, and the well-being of all that's neither passive nor violent. It's a way of being. It's a way of life. And it isn't. And it's a way of person in our life. And it's also betting that we can create structures where that make that regarding each other in this way more possible, more doable. So it does include struggle and long-term efforts to make shifts on particular issues, but also long-term to create a culture of peace and nonviolence. So mainstreaming nonviolence is not about creating a utopia. It's not creating an ideal world. Mainstreaming nonviolence means that we, you, me, everyone, increasingly is getting the tools for dealing with the violence and injustice that's in our world. So in the 19th century, many countries, including the United States, made a really historic decision, which was, we're going to teach everyone to read. That had not been the case. That had been the province, typically, of elite men. But there was a decision that we're going to mainstream literacy. And you couldn't say, well, we've achieved that totally, or that everyone ideally comprehends. But we've mainstreamed that. That's become the default. That's really the default position, even if it hasn't been achieved entirely. Well, the same thing is now needed. We need nonviolent literacy. We need to help people see that we have more power than we think to make change. And so how do we spread those not only vision, but toolbox and principles and methods? That's mainstreaming nonviolence. And campaign nonviolence has taken that as a watchword for what we're trying to do, I'd say, in three ways. One, generationally. This is not going to happen overnight. Secondly, intergenerationally. It's not just going to be old people or young people. All of us have to be involved in this. And all parts of our society. And then third, multi-generationally. This is something that's going to take us a while to create that paradigm shift. But, Chris, I would say from my own experience, and I've been at this now for, it feels like 500 years, but it's it's been 30 years, I've seen that we have more power than we think, and we can actually make change, and I've seen that in so many different ways.
Yeah, I agree. And I also want to remind everybody that I'm speaking with Ken Buttigan, who is the director of Pace Bene and one of the lead people in Campaign Nonviolence that's we want to define next. But I also want to wish everybody a happy birthday to Mohandas Gandhi and also to our founder of our Chico Peace Endeavor, Wilhelmina Taggart, both of who are no longer with us. But can you tell us about Campaign Nonviolence, please?
Sure. Campaign Nonviolence is a long-term movement for a culture of peace and nonviolence free from war, poverty, racism, environmental destruction, and for good measure, the epidemic of violence. So it's a big job. And a couple of years ago, some of us who'd been involved in lots of different campaigns and issues over the years had a retreat in Chicago in 2012. And we mulled on this. Well, what is the next step toward a culture of peace and nonviolence? And felt that connecting the dots between issues and movements and campaigns was going to be very important to generate the people power necessary to meet these massive and monumental challenges we face as a planet and as people. And so that's a key part of this, is how do we connect those dots? How do we come together? How do we find one another? How do we get outside our silos? And then how do we create a culture of peace and nonviolence? And so we, for 2 years now, have organized a week called Campaign Nonviolence Week of Actions. And we just concluded, as you mentioned, the second annual Week of Actions all across this country and in 9 other nations. In every one of our 50 states, this past week, we took 370 actions for peace, marches, rallies, demonstrations, vigils, and many other events. And basically, we're calling for that culture of peace and nonviolence, connecting these dots, and taking action together. And if I could say something about where we're going next,
yes.
We see the next the last 2 years is kind of laying the groundwork. How do we actually spread this word nonviolence, which for some of us, it's kind of a new word, or it's a word that doesn't have much meaning. And what we've been trying to do is deepen that meaning over the last 2 years in the spirit of Mohandas Gandhi, we're celebrating today, and Dr. King and many others. As we go forward, first of all, over the next year, we're going to take nonviolent action. We're going to foster nonviolent culture. We're going to expand nonviolence training. We're going to nurture a movement of movements. We're going to spread resources for peaceful change. And we're going to build out Campaign Nonviolence even further. So what does that all mean? Well, first of all, I invite your listeners to put on their calendars our next week of nonviolent actions, the 2016 Campaign Nonviolence Action Week, September 18th through the 25th, 2016. Take action globally for a culture of peace and nonviolence. So again, we're going to march for justice, peace, and environmental healing throughout the U.S. and around the world. We've decided, based on some response we've seen around the country, including those 70,000 peace cranes that graced the Campaign Nonviolence conference and our marches at Los Alamos in August, we've decided to really make a call globally for Campaign Nonviolence to move forward around the world. So that's the first thing. Second thing is what we're calling the Nonviolent Cities Project. Build a culture of peace and nonviolence where you are. So, Chris, imagine nonviolent Chico.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine nonviolent Los Angeles.
Right.
Nonviolent New York City or nonviolent Kabul. What would it take to foster a nonviolent city where you live, where I live? So this next year, we're calling on communities everywhere to imagine what their nonviolent city would entail, to identify what would be involved in achieving this, and to take concrete steps toward this long-term goal. Very long-term effort, but connecting the dots of all the things that are already happening, like everything happening in Chico already for justice and peace, but then saying, how can we name this as a nonviolent city? And we see this as a great platform for connecting the dots and nurturing culture, peace, and nonviolence as part of campaign nonviolence.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I love the idea of connecting the dots. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, third, we have what we call the 1,000 Trainings Project. And we're inviting people everywhere to host nonviolence training, workshops, classes, webinars in their city. Nonviolence education, of course, is key to long-term change by spreading the tools of nonviolent transformation and by training advocates for change and our larger society. So we've begun working with training organizations across the country and also longtime nonviolence trainers, including Peter Burgell and David Soleil, who are longtime agents of change, to identify and organize at least 1,000 trainings and workshops for nonviolence change over the next year. And we call on every local group to host, organize, or lead a nonviolence training. In 2016, the Close Pache Bene and Campaign Nonviolence will work with you and help you with that.
Yeah, and, you know, I was just, you know how the mind works. There's the yes, but. So here's the but. You talk about this, and I am part of it, so I'm kind of like with this wonderful ideas that are coming up. But what about the tendency of people to be so busy and so taken up with their own lives and with social media, etc.? We are so overwhelmed. How are we going to reach out beyond the choir?
Right. Well, that's exactly what mainstream nonviolence is about. How do we help have a conversation with our society to say, do we really want to continue to go in the direction that violence might is right, that it answers the question, and that's our big answer for things? I think we have to have that conversation in our society. And it is true, everybody's busy. At the same time, you know, if you look back in the past when great movements emerged, including the civil rights movement, people were pretty busy then too. But they made this a priority. And our job as a movement is to help our society make this a priority. So part of it is how do we invite the institutions that we're already part of to offer venues and platforms for seeing that this actually works. And let me just say, as to your question, when I lead a lot of trainings, I find that some people are dragged to those trainings, maybe by their spouse or their friend.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be there, and you can tell in their attitude. But if they hang in there about halfway through, what I find, Chris, is about halfway through the process, a light bulb comes on.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, oh, my gosh, I've lived with the burden of violence my whole life. In fact, I've been violent. But at the same time, I've also been nonviolent, even though I never maybe called it that. And by the end of the training and the evaluation, they're saying things like, you people are thinking too small. We have to build this out across the whole country. So a big challenge in terms of your question is, how do we have that first possible experience with people who are skeptical or who have never been taught another way or who are too busy? And I think that's our challenge. We have to make this fun and exciting. We also, as I was saying, we also have to really see if institutions that exist already can begin to integrate this. So, for example, in our religious communities, in our schools, a vision of K through 12 nonviolence education as developmentally appropriate, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to happen overnight, and I understand the resistance and the inertia. At the same time, our job is, just like you're doing with your radio program, is to help all of us catch that vision that, oh, it is possible to have an alternative. And then sometimes when really horrible injustice or violence happens, we go, well, why didn't we prepare for that, for the nonviolent alternative? Or in my own life, why couldn't have I prepared for that terrible conversation I have with my mother or my boss?
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to do it so that we're prepared ahead of time.
Right. And I don't think we're asking people to be frenetic and jump from crisis to crisis, like what just happened in Oregon and the whole gun thing. And then, you know, one day I'm at Creech Air Force Base and the next day I'm, you know. I mean, I don't think that people have to live that way. People are already doing the work. It's just to identify how can we connect these dots and move it more into the language and the thinking of nonviolence. Is that right?
That's so well put, Chris. So many of us, whether it's in raising our children or working on sustainable food supplies or deciding that we want to see nonviolence in our local schools or school districts, all these things are happening. And part of what the beauty of Campaign Nonviolence is exactly what you're saying, is creating a framework in which we see there's actually that nonviolent shift is in process and that we're part of it. And part of what we are trying to do in this movement is to affirm and lift up and celebrate all the amazing work that people are already doing. And my experience is once we begin to do that and that starts to get a tipping point and traction, then you begin to say, that actually is the default. And, that actually is happening more than I thought, and I'm part of something bigger than myself, bigger than this moment, and we're actually moving toward a world where these kinds of solutions are possible.
Right. And what I there's so much about what you've done that I'm so interested in. You also spoke on something called Occupy Radio, and the key question at that time was how do you build a world that works for everyone? So I think that a lot of what's happening in this country with Black Lives Matter and the focus, especially in our community, on homelessness and some of the meanness that comes out when people talk about the homeless, it's all part of uplift for everyone, and I like that very much about it. The beloved community, is that something you can tell us about?
Absolutely. That wonderful phrase from Dr. King, the beloved community where everyone matters. Dr. King framed it also as the world house. We're all living in the same house. It's just some of us are down at the end with the swimming pool and the others are down at the end with no running water or roof. But we're all in the same house, and that we, the sooner we recognize that and take concrete steps, not simply to say that, but actually to live that. My brother Larry died on the streets as a homeless person. I'm one of eight children, and I know that's why I'm an activist, because I saw what this system does to people who are on the streets. And we, each of us in our own way, tried to offer support for my brother Larry. He was very restless because of what had happened to him in his life and how the system had dealt with him. But he has called to me constantly in life and after life to create a world where everyone matters, and that led to various campaigns around homelessness, for example, in San Francisco, California, when I lived there, and the efforts, the movements that we built there for that.